Good morning, Ohio Valley. This is Dan Lima with OSU Extension.
And this is Karen Cox with WVU Extension. I hope you all have had a great weekend so far. And I know the second cutting is getting up, but let's go ahead and talk about some grain prices before we move on to hay.
All right, cutting it, getting right to it. All right, here are your cash prices for grains and feeds Monday, August 17, 2015. So barley top quality, price not available. Man, this is a great start. Okay, corn, number two, yellow dented corn. It's 346 and a half. A year ago, Karen, it was going for 358 and a half. Oats are at 258 and a quarter. A year ago, they were at 379. And if we go to soybeans, they're going for 955. A year ago, they were at 1241. Wheat is at 482. A year ago, they were at 613. That means a lot of the grain prices are still low compared to what they were last year.
Well, that's good for those of us who need to buy it, but not so good for those of us who are trying to sell it. So cattle prices are still looking all right. We'll give you our market report on the livestock now. Yeah.
Once we had to wrestle the paper a little bit, but it's we caught it. So, all right, I guess I'll do it. it's been a rough day. All right, Barnesville Livestock Auctions. This is for Saturday, August 15th, 2015. 353 total head, 241 cattle. So if we're looking at medium size steers and bulls, going straight to the 300 to 400 pound range, it goes from 205 to 295. 400 to 500 pound range, 120 to 275. And from 500 to 600 pound range, we are looking at 130 to 215. And if we're looking at the heifers, 3 to 400 pound heifers went from 160 to 250. 4 to 500 pound heifers ranged from 145 to 257. And 5 to 600 pound heifers went from 110 to 200. And because we have a lot in this class, let's go ahead and go 600 to 700 pound heifers. That price range went from 122.50 to 207. So everything from, let's see, let's kind of break this down in terms of the spread. 110 to 295, so almost $3 a pound.
Yeah, so with prices like that, you want to make sure that your heifers are fertile and that your bulls are doing good out there in the fields. And also make sure that you are up on all of your vaccinations and that you are keeping the nutrient minerals to par for this particular stage in your animal's livestock and in your animal's life, because as we all know, once the heifers are pregnant, they have different nutrient demands and you do not want to lose those calves. So make sure you're staying up on your selenium and your other minerals, and hopefully you'll have a good year for calves.
Yeah, once again, this just demonstrates that agriculture is a very dependent industry for the weather and unpredictability. I mean, with this inconsistent rain, too much rain, to droughts, to too much rain again all of a sudden. There's a lot of inconsistencies, and with corn prices, you know, those were definitely affected. So that can infect one farmer in one way and another farmer in a completely opposite way. So it's a tough industry, but hopefully, you know, there are good programs to take advantage of out there, and hopefully you've been looking into those. And again, as Karen was saying, for if you have a lot of crop damages, it's a very important thing to report those to the USDA and make sure they're aware of that.
Yeah, and this especially applies if you have crop insurance or livestock insurance where you've lost some value from either flooding or drought. Make sure that you're reporting that so that you're getting your full coverage benefits. And another thing that all of this strange water, overwhelming water and then lack of water is doing is it's changing some of the chemical balances in our soils. So we're seeing some different nitrogen values in the soils as a direct result of waterlogging. And we're going to talk a little bit about soils and the importance of soil testing and some of the things that you should be looking for.
Right. And with all the topsoil losses and all the heavy rainfalls, two things can happen. You can lose nitrogen and a lot of your nutrients in the topsoil through either erosion or through leaching of nitrogen. So we're going to kind of talk about different ways to supplement your soil and get the most out of your soil and make sure that what you're putting down is really what you want, because it doesn't help you at all if what you're thinking is a lot of nitrogen really isn't. So we're going to kind of break down some of the chemicals out there that you can use to supplement a soil test, or hopefully you are doing a soil test and you're supplementing accordingly, because there's nothing, it's really a waste of money to supplement things that you don't need, because then you'll still be lacking in certain nutrients that maybe you don't need to be putting down. So that's a waste of money. You'll be throwing off the ratios that are important, and we're going to touch on a couple of those. And that's going to actually be harmful to your production. And sometimes you think you're putting down a lot of nitrogen, but you're really not. So hopefully, you know, we'll discuss some of the chemicals out there and what the percentages are of certain compounds. But it is very important to make sure you get a soil test so that you know exactly what you're putting on and you're putting the proper amounts.
Yes, definitely get it tested, because if you're looking at fertilizers, more is better is not the best outlook for that, simply because not only are fertilizers extremely expensive and they take time and effort to apply, but you can also cause some excessive nutrient toxicity to your plants. And so I know a lot of us, or a lot of you out there, use manure as your fertilizer, and that's great because that helps to keep a nice organic substance on the fields, which improves the biota in the soil. But let's talk just about numbers here. For a dairy cattle manure, you're looking at 4.3% nitrogen. Potassium, you're looking at 4.0%. And for phosphorus, and yeah, I know I got those out of order, you're looking at 1.8%.
They don't know that.
Well, everyone knows the NPK. It always goes NPK. It can't go NKP. That just doesn't work. Anyway, for swine, your nitrogen is going to be a lot higher with swine. You're getting up to 14%, which is 10% higher than your cattle. And then also your phosphorus is 4.3%. Again, it's higher than cattle manure. And your potassium is 5.3%. Once again, it's higher. Your poultry layer, your layer poultry, you're going to look at 3.9% nitrogen, which is comparable to the cattle. And also your phosphorus is going to be the big change here. You get 7% phosphorus in your poultry manure, as opposed to 4.3 in the swine and the 1.8 of the cattle manure. Your 3.8 is potassium is 3.8%, which is about just probably the lowest of them all. But if you're looking for phosphorus, your poultry manure is your best. If you need nitrogen, you want to look towards the swine. And dairy cattle is just sort of a nice low mix that'll just keep those critters under the ground happy and eating.
That's right, Karen. So, you know, we're looking at the breakdown of the different manures. And one thing that is important to emphasize here is this is the average of range nutrients, concentrations in manures, and this is percent of dry matter. So when you're talking about dry matter, you're really probably talking about 10% of the total weight of fresh. And that's probably an over-exaggeration. So, you know, really small amounts here in terms of nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. So typically, when we want to put down just nitrogen in the soil, we use urea. And urea is actually what, you know, we as humans and animals excrete as having too much nitrogen. I mean, it's, you know, it is. I'm getting a funny look
urea,
from Karen.
Urea, urine, same thing.
Well, it's, yeah. Well, urine, urea is the nitrogen compound in urine. So, all right. So for agricultural use, when we talk about urea, we talk about a solid, a crystalline solid of that molecule. It's typically two nitrogens and a carbon and an oxygen. So the percentage, the total percentage, I mean, so I want to say it's a chemical fertilizer. Karen and I were discussing this, but it's also an organic, it's organic in terms of it's a carbon molecule that has nitrogen in it. So not organic as in certified organic, but organic as in it contains carbon. So when we put urea down, you're actually putting in 16% nitrogen, which is much higher than a manure's. And the manure has to be broken down for that nitrogen to be available to your crop. It's not instantly available. So it has to be processed by microbes in the soil. So yes, I mean, I'm not saying it's not useful. It's very useful. It adds a lot of texture to your soil. It adds the different elements, and it's going to add a lot of that carbon-nitrogen ratio, which is very important for leaching. And leaching occurs when you get too much rain and you have a lot of the rain, the ammonia in the soil soluble in the rainwater, and it basically just gets removed from your soil. That carbon ratio is going to help hold it in place. But if you're just putting down manure for the sake of nitrogen, that's probably not your best source of nitrogen.
Yeah, that's right. So if you're only using nitrogen or manure for your nitrogen, you want to make sure you have a good legume mix out there to help contribute to the nitrogen mix in the pasture to ensure that your grasses are getting enough nitrogen to grow. Because remember, every time you take off the top of that grass, you're taking away nitrogen. So you need to make sure that your returns equal what's removed. So you have to continually return it when you are taking something away. I mean, if this was a closed system and the grass grew and the cows ate it and pooped and never went anywhere else, but there was enough space for the cattle to move on to the next field on their own, then you wouldn't have to worry about it as much. But since we're doing a more intensive type of management system where we're trying to get as many cattle on a small amount of land as possible, we have to make sure that we are returning enough nitrogen to keep that grass growing at a rate that's healthy enough for our animals.
And not only that, but if you're taking hay off your fields, you're actually removing all those nutrients directly. So you're actually, there's a direct output that you're removing, which is all the nitrogen that the plant utilized to make all those amino acids, to make the high protein hay that people love to buy. And that's where that nitrogen goes. It goes into making proteins for the plant. Typically alfalfa, even though it's a legume, because it has a lot of those little leaves in it, makes a lot of protein, really high quality hay typically. But alfalfa was a really bad example because it can reduce nitrogen and puts it in the soil. So on that note, having a legume, having a nitrogen fixer on your land is a great asset. And there's so many different types. There's clovers, and you can get white clover or red clover, and there's every variety in between those. If you do a heavy intensive grazing, you might want to have a more low growing clover like white clover. And if you bale a lot of hay and you're removing that nitrogen, maybe a red clover is probably more suitable for that, so you can get those high protein type forages in your hay. But at the same time, now you're removing all that nitrogen and you have to put it back in one way or another.
Yeah, those are very good examples of how you want to alter the plants in the field to be either pasture plants versus hay plants. Your hay plants, you want to be able to dry quickly, to be durable when they're dry. The more you thresh your hay in the windrows, trying to get it to dry like we had to do with our first cutting this year, you're going to break up those clover leaves and you're going to lose some of that protein content. So you want to make sure that you are monitoring what you're harvesting off the field. And if it's not in the soil, it's not going to be in the plants. I know West Virginia soils are low in selenium. Cattle need selenium, so you need to make sure that you're giving them that mineral supplementation with your hay. Same goes for corn silage. If you're doing corn silage, you got to make sure you have the proper nutrients in the soil to keep the corn healthy so that it can in turn keep the cattle healthy. And I'm going to go off on a quick tangent here, if you don't mind, Dan.
Do I ever mind?
So one of the things that we always stress when we're talking about harvesting hay or silage and baling it up is moisture content. And moisture meters are pretty expensive. Not horribly expensive when it comes to farm equipment, but they're going to run you a good $200 to $300. A moisture tester is a very valuable tool on the farm, especially when you're trying to ensure the highest quality materials that are coming off the farm. But if you don't happen to have an extra $200 to $300 right now, here's a quick and dirty way to get a good idea of the moisture content of your hay or silage. So what you're going to want to do is you're going to chop it up into 1-inch squares and all you need is a microwave and a kitchen scale. And the kitchen scale has to be able to measure down to 1/10 of a gram. And so you're going to chop up your silage into 1-inch squares, and you're going to put it on a paper plate. Make sure you've teared out the weight of the plate off of the total weight. So you want exactly 100 grams of silage on this paper plate. And then you're going to put 3/4 of a cup of water in the microwave in the back corner, and then put the paper plate in the microwave. You're going to cook it for about 2 minutes, take it out, and measure the weight again. And you're going to put it back in. Make sure that water stays 3/4 way full so that your silage doesn't scorch, because if it scorches, you have to start all over again. So you keep doing it until the weight stabilizes. Once the weight stabilizes and it's no longer losing weight through cooking, you have taken out all the moisture content from your silage, and what's left is the silage, and what's gone is the moisture content. So say, for instance, you have 100 grams to start with, and you have 40 grams when you're done, then you know your silage had 60% moisture in it. So that's just a quick and dirty way. It's not as exact as a moisture meter, but if you're not going to get a moisture meter, this is better than nothing, because it's really important to know the moisture content of what you're baling to not only keep it from losing nutrients as it sweats, but also to keep it from catching on fire from anaerobic activity.
Wow, that's very, very, very good tip. Excellent. And
all right, so back to the dirt.
back to the dirt. Okay. All right. So here's what I want to talk about. So Epsom salts. You know, we hear that. I hear that a lot being thrown around. But a lot of people don't know what Epsom salt is. It's magnesium sulfate. So does it have a lot of nitrogen?
No, it does not. It
doesn't have any nitrogen. Magnesium sulfate, Epsom salt, is magnesium and sulfur. So you're only supplementing those two things with Epsom salt. Same thing with gypsum salts. Gypsum is calcium sulfate, which is a salt, but we call it gypsum, calcium and sulfur. So, you know, if you did a soil test and you have to balance out that calcium and magnesium, those are going to be the best ways to do it. You know, you can either, if you're too high on the magnesium, you could put in Epsom salts. If you're too high on the, or I'm sorry, if you're too low on the magnesium, put in Epsom salts to supplement the magnesium. But if you are low on the calcium, put in the gypsum to supplement the calcium sulfate. And again, when you're doing a soil test, typically it's recommended that you have that 1-to-1 ratio for magnesium and calcium.
Yeah, and just another thing, when you're doing your soil test, if you are managing pasture land or hay, you always want to make sure your magnesium is up, especially for spring feeding, so that way you can avoid grass tetany. So it's good to know how much magnesium is present in your soil, so you know if you need to supplement in the springtime.
And another important ratio here is the magnesium to potassium ratio, which should be less than 2-to-1. So if your magnesium level is more than 2 times the potassium level, that can give you some nutritional issues for the plant in terms of taking up the nutrients. Remember that all these ions are going to be in the soil, and then the plant has to be able to use them at the proper ratio so that it's not saturated with just one thing, and then the crop doesn't get all the nutrition it requires. It's kind of like the whole pH thing. You know, if you don't have the proper pH, you're not going to be effectively taking up the proper nutrients for that plant. And different plants have different ideal pH requirements. So being able to lime or to acidify as necessary is going to be really important for the kind of for your results and yield and health of your plant in the end. So just some in Ohio, you know. That might translate to here in Western West Virginia also. Western West Virginia. Yeah, that's right. I had to think about that one for a minute.
Good job there, Dan.
All right. So anyway, so here in Ohio, we rarely have calcium deficiencies. For magnesium, light textured soils and those with forages have that issue. So, you know, Karen was absolutely right. You know, we have lighter textured soils. We are in the non-glaciated areas. Our soil in eastern Ohio is not nearly that black, organic, good soil that they have in western Ohio that grows anything. I need to stop talking now. No, but it's quite a visual effect. I mean, it's different, but we have that magnesium issue. So keep that in mind. You know, don't just say, hey, I need a lot of magnesium because I heard Dan talking about in eastern Ohio, we typically have this problem. No, I'm saying with the light textured soils and all the forages that we have in eastern Ohio, it's a good idea to do the soil test to be able to verify that you might have that magnesium deficiency. And once again, in the springtime, it's very important to know that so that you're not getting grass tetany on your animals.
Yeah, those are all good points, Dan. It's important to recognize that there are different soil characteristics, even within small regions. A lot of it depends on what happened long before we were even here and how the soil got laid down. Everyone always assumes that all soils in West Virginia are highly acidic. And in a lot of cases, that is true. But there are also calcareous soils in West Virginia where they're actually more basic. And so if you're just randomly applying lime and you happen to have one of those calcareous pockets, then you're actually going to make you're going to end up having some of the problems that they have out west, where you have too much or too basic of a soil and your plants are losing nutrients on that end of the spectrum, and simply adding more lime is not going to fix things for you. So it's really important to know what you have, to know your soil type, to know what its consistency is too, because knowing the texture of your soil is going to give you some key indicators about how it holds on to nutrients as well.
Yeah, and here's a cool little trick I learned the other day when we had our soils class for the naturalist group. We had, what's his name, Steve Probonic from Ohio Department of Natural Resources come in, and we talked a lot about soil texture. So three main components of soil, you have sand, silt, and clay. Sand being one of the largest molecule in there with the best drainage. So a sandier soil will typically have better drainage than more of a clay-type material. We are in eastern Ohio, we have more of a silt clay type soil. But if you were to take a little clump of soil in your fingers, topsoil, and you know, make sure it's nice and wet and just start rubbing it together till you get this muddy residue on your fingers, you can start to feel, if you feel rough grains of sand, then it's almost like it starts to feel like sandpaper. And then you know that you have sand in your soils. If it's real sticky, then that's typically a sign of high concentrations of clay and silt, which don't drain as well as sandy soils. So it's just a nice little quick trick to find out the texture of your soil.
Yeah, and your loams are going to be more of a smooth, silky feeling too. So it's really a neat thing, you know. It's a fun thing, especially, you know, take the kids or the grandkids out and have them play in the mud. I mean, they always hate that, right? So yeah, that's a fun trick to do.
All right, so we've talked a little bit about nitrogen, magnesium, and calcium, and oh, don't forget when you are liming, there are various types of lime you can use too. So you have high mag lime, you have high calcium lime, and you have dolomitic, which is going to be both. So if you're short in both in a soil test, well, your best bet is dolomitic lime. But if you're short in one versus the other, or you need to adjust those ratios, you know, you have the option of either going to the magnesium or the calcium for liming to bring up the pH. And I'm going to take it just one step further and just kind of wrap up our previous conversation and say that if you're not adjusting the pH, stay away from lime altogether and make sure you do things like the Epsom salts and the gypsum to fix those calcium and magnesium ratios. So there we go. So there's so many options to amend the soil. But let's talk about phosphorus too, because, you know, we talked about the percentages of manure being not as high as urea that you can put down. And we were talking about nitrogen being lost with leaching and with soil erosion. And with nitrogen, another big deal that you can lose is the phosphorus. So it's a good idea not to put too much phosphorus down when you're working with these when you're working with fertilizers and you're working, whether it's a garden or a hay field or a pasture, you want to make sure that you are within the bounds of the tri-state recommendations, at least for Ohio, Karen. I'm sure you guys will have similar ratios for phosphorus runoffs too in West Virginia. But, you know, for the tri-state recommendations, and these can vary a little bit. I'm getting like the funniest grin from Karen right now. But if you're growing, just as an example, if you're growing corn and soybeans, your maintenance range is going to be from 15 parts per million to 30 parts per million. So if you're above, and that's corn and soybeans, and then wheat and alfalfa, again, you're going from 25 parts per million to 40 parts per million. So 40 is going to be the higher range of the phosphorus levels that we like to recommend. So if you're sitting at 50 parts per million, or that would translate to roughly 100 pounds of phosphorus per acre, then we would recommend you not put down any more phosphorus, because you're at that management limit, and you need to decrease the amount of phosphorus available. If you're below that 15 parts per million, well, you need to build up that phosphorus, and the recommendations are going to be able to get you to that maintenance range between, and I'm just going to generalize it, 15 and 40, to keep it so that your plants will have enough phosphorus and you're not going to get through erosion and leaching an excess of nutrients of nitrogen and phosphorus and everything else into bodies of water and have harmful algae blooms. And as I keep talking, I look at the clock, and we're running low on time here. But again, I want to wrap up the show now. We talked a lot about manures and different types of fertilizers and different ways to amend things based on a soil test. So you have a lot of options, and Karen and I are both here. One of our main jobs is to make sure that your soil is healthy and that you can amend it to the highest level, so that you can have the best yields in your land, whether it's a backyard. I always get tongue-tied at the very end when it's critical. Whether it's a backyard garden, lawn, hay field, pasture field, whatever it is, you know, there is a way to optimize it for your production. So I'm going to go ahead and sign off and give Karen a chance to speak. So this is Dan Lima with OSU Extension in Belmont County. And you can reach me at 740-695-1455. I almost gave away my phone number.
All right. And my name is Karen Cox, and I'm for the Ohio County Extension Office for West Virginia University Extension. And you can reach me at 304-234-3673 or at Karen, K-A-R-E-N, Cox, at mail@wvu.edu. Thanks for listening, all, and have a great week.